You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Listen, I've been thinking.
Really?
About why we're so good together.
Why is that?
Well, your crazy matches my crazy. Big time.
Hmm.
I missed you too, Adam.
After a few weeks apart, Josh and I bring the crazy back for our top five films of 2016 so far. Helping us out, our buddy Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune.
You really want to get crazy? Bring in Michael Phillips.
Absolutely. Ryan Reynolds in that clip from Deadpool, one of the year's big hits. But is it top five worthy? We'll see. That and more ahead on Film Spotting. It has been a couple of weeks, Josh, since we've been in the studio together, both on family vacations, separate family vacations, had some guest hosts.
There will be a year where we do the joint Film Spotting family vacation.
Well, we sort of have that with our little spring green trip.
Yeah, it's an overnighter.
Yeah.
A week altogether? I don't know if we're ready for that.
Maybe not. We do want to thank Nerdettes, Trisha Bobita, and Melissa Tanninga from Seattle Screen Scene for helping us out these past couple weeks. It's fun to introduce a few new voices into the mix, but you can't be bringing back a familiar voice, and he is Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Michael, how are you?
I'm familiar. Thank you. How are you?
Do you want in on that joint family vacation, Michael? Add your brood?
I'm just here to counter-argue, Adam. I don't think you can do both. You can't bring new people in and still, you know, accommodate the old people.
Duly noted. I think I noticed that maybe you were on a little bit of a family vacation as well.
I may have.
Did you get some R&R?
Yes, I got R&R. We had a really good vacation to my folks and my brother's family in Albuquerque. And we saw a little bit of Colorado, and you know, we did a tie-dyeing project, which was just a smashing
success. You look thrilled in the photos I saw.
Yeah, I look a little. I was going for like tough guy surly, but it came out like gastrointestinal troubles.
It's hard to pull that off when you're crafting.
Yes, that's right. No, we had a great time.
Well, it is great to have you back on the show. We're going to share our top five films of 2016 so far, and we're going to hear from some different voices as we work our way through this list, some guest voicemailers, a few listener comments as well. And speaking of Melissa Tanninga, because we just can't get enough of her, she did such a good job last week on the show with me, we're going to start off this list with her voicemail and her pick for the best film of the year.
Hi, Adam and Josh. This is Melissa Tanninga from Seattle Screen Scene, and my favorite film of 2016 so far is Terrence Davies' Sunset Song. I know, Josh, you were a little more mixed on this one, but for me it is a deeply evocative film with an emotional core that gets at the often baffling complexities of human experience. I love how Davies wraps us up into a sense of loss and joy together, love and hate, and he does it through the characters, of course, but also so importantly through the music of the film and also the visual imagery, there are these gorgeous dissolves that say two things at once, and we're asked to embrace the mystery of the unity of those two things. In the same way that you might love a song, I guess, that is deeply painful and also beautiful at the same time. And all that sounds very abstract, but part of what makes the film's abstract elements so effective is its commitment to a very specific time and place. It is about this very specifically 20th century Scottish woman, and it immerses us in her Scottish experience and her perspective. But like all the best stories, the specificity somehow makes it all the more universal. So that is Terence Davies' Sunset Song, and I hope that film spotters get a chance to check it out if they haven't already.
Indeed, Josh, on the wrong side of that Terence Davies film. But Michael, we were on the right side. I have a feeling, though, it's not going to make either of our lists. I guess this year was just pretty good so far.
Yeah, you know, Terence Davies is a filmmaker who, you know, the fact that this doesn't quite make my top five of the first half of 2016, it's, who knows? It could just slip into that, you know, a top 10 slot by the end of the year. He's just a filmmaker you've returned to kind of no matter what material he's after, whether or not you thought you had any interest in this Scottish novel, which is, which in Scotland is it's like the national novel, mm-hmm. Or previous film, the Terence Rattigan play, he adapted the Deep Blue Sea, whether or not one had any interest in Rattigan, an early 50s dramatist, that doesn't get much currency in the
West. I was unfamiliar with both when I watched these films, and I love both.
Love both, yeah. No, and the rhythmic change that Davies asks of you is a very interesting one, and sometimes you're just not, some will work better for you than others, but I find his work completely seductive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a great pick.
Well, we're going to stick with you and hopefully get another great pick, your number five film of 2016 so far, Michael.
Well, slightly lower down the pulp chain than Terence Davies. My number five is The Invitation, the thriller set in L.A. that was directed by Karen Kusama. I find that this film, as modest and unpretentious as it is, has really lingered with me. And I find its simple premise of this dinner party, this notion of a couple that suffered a tragedy and then broke up, and then you have this sort of mysterious culty type trip to Mexico that sort of shadows all the action and informs all this mysterious goings on at what looks to be just sort of a good time LA dinner party, turns really sinister. And I'm really keen on where this film goes and how it gets there. It's essentially a very claustrophobic house party gone wrong thriller.
Is everything okay, Will?
Yeah. Yeah, why don't you leave the key in the door, though?
Yeah, there was a home invasion up in the canyon about a month ago. This couple got terrorized. It was really sick. Just kind of freaked us out.
I didn't hear about it.
I'm sure it never happened. Yeah, come on, Will. Can a man put himself in lockdown if he wants? This is America.
Okay, what if there was a fire?
Didn't get the audience I think it deserved, but, I think Kusama films it beautifully, and I just love the last 2 minutes to remind. It was one of the best thriller endings I'd seen since Hitchcock's The Birds.
Well, I think it's going to get sinister in here right now because I haven't seen it, but Josh, you have, and you
have.
Not
okay.
As impressed.
Well, so I'm not very confident in my trouble with Sunset Song. I think go with Melissa and the rest of you guys there. That's one I just didn't get on board with. The Invitation, which I couldn't wait to watch because, again, like you said, this quiet little thriller out of nowhere that people were raving about. I thought this is going to be great. And man, was this all over the place in terms of tone and performance. And it just seemed like, for me, it could never get modulated into that sort of simmering tension, especially for a confined space film that I expected. And at one point, these people are at each other's throats. And the next, it's like, it's time for the dessert, so let's all sit down.
Yeah,
it just seemed like so poorly
like
modulated.
I see your point. It's not a screw tightener in the way that, say, if any number of directors, say, if David Fincher had gotten a hold of the material, it would have been a gut-wrenching film. But yeah, this film is more disarming and a little more sidewinding, I think. But for some reason, I went with it. And I think your problem, Josh, is that you went in with high expectations. I went in hating it, not having seen it, but hating
I'm going to start that.
That helps.
And then slowly liking it because I realized it was good.
I'll see if that helps going forward. You know, the ending, though, you're right about. I mean, great final shot. And I just wish the rest of the movie had earned that. But that one sticks with you.
Hey, the public voted with you, Josh. So I think I better get out of here, guys.
We need you for a while.
An auspicious beginning. Josh, your number five.
My number five, I'm going to let a listener help me out with this one.
Hey, this is Joshua Solomon from Tallahassee, Florida. My favorite film of 2016 so far is The Witch, or The Vitch, however you sort of spell it. Just incredibly scary, haunting in a very unique way, thought-provoking. It has a lot to say about religion and history, and I loved all the performances as well. Best horror film I've seen in a very long time. Thanks. Bye.
So The Witch is Robert Eggers' 1630s set horror piece, and I think that time and place has a lot to do with what Joshua described, how the movie is haunting in a very unique way. Despite this being a low-budget independent film, it has this impeccable sense of historicity to it, and that's thanks to the production design particularly and also the costuming. The story itself involves it's about a family in search of religious purity. So they separate themselves from their community to live at the edge of a wood where they encounter both their own fallibility and an actual witch. It's sort of a chicken and the witch situation here. What comes first? That's one of the dynamics that's pretty fascinating and relates to the religious elements Joshua referred to. I do think the movie doesn't quite know what to do with its devilishness at the end. That's the one
literally
point of resistance for me. Yeah. And in the process, what happens is it loses some of its ambiguity. But overall, this is a really disturbing movie experience. And really, I know we still have 6 months to go, but as of right now, I'm pretty confident in saying the award for movie animal of the year, it's a fight between Keanu's cute kitten and the witch's Black Phillip, aka Satan's pet goat.
The goat, Black Phillip.
Well, there may be some more witch talk to come, and I think I'll hold off because I did finally catch up with it. It was the big 2016 movie I knew I had to see before sitting down for this list.
And anybody can at this point because it's on DVD, available streaming. I think the invitation is widely available as well if listeners want to catch up with that.
Well, I love top five lists like this because it's always exciting when you're passionate about your picks. And how could we not be passionate? We're listing our top five films of the year so far. But it's also a little bit more exciting when you're encouraging people to see movies that were overlooked. And this wasn't my plan coming in. I didn't have an agenda, but it is the way it worked out. One of my picks, I would say, definitely got all the attention it deserved. The other four grossed an average at the box office of $3.4 million. And that's only because one of them made $8.3 million. So people need to see these movies, and hopefully this will encourage them to do so. My number five is Born to be Blue, the Chet Baker pseudo biopic, I guess, directed by Robert Boudreau, 41-year-old filmmaker who is new to me. He's made a handful of shorts and one other feature, 2006's That Beautiful Somewhere. A voicemailer here in a little bit is going to bring up a point that I'm going to make with this film as well. The material is good. Baker's story is inherently compelling. I think he was this major figure in jazz, a West Coast jazz pioneer. His name was synonymous with cool jazz. But the success of this movie is so much more about he constructs and how he interprets the material. He avoids making a key mistake that a lot of people who make biopics make, which is they try to bite off too much and tell an entire life story. He focuses on a key point in Baker's life in the 1960s when he was strung out, he was completely washed up and was attempting a comeback, and then the romance that more or less saves him, the ending of this film. Talk about great endings. It's my favorite final shot and favorite final moments of the year so far. Boudreau not only avoids the biopic mistake, but he inserts just the right amount of self-reflexivity from the very beginning to cue us into the fact as audience members that he knows that we know we're watching a biopic, and he tells us we should settle in because there are going to be some surprises along the way. So for me, it's a perfect marriage of content and form. The movie just kind of glides along like one of Baker's smoky, smooth ballads. And the tune can catch you, or maybe it won't. I was locked into this movie right from the beginning, and it helps that it has two of the best performances of the year, Ethan Hawke as Chet Baker and Carmen Ejogo, who played Coretta Scott King in Selma. Both are wonderful. And Born to Be Blue is out on DVD, Amazon, and iTunes July 26. But it's been playing on demand, movies on demand on cable, depending on your provider. But again, you can wait till July 26 and see it that way as well.
I'm embarrassed to say this is one that I have not seen yet, that I promise I will certainly catch up with it before the end
of the
year.
I look forward to your reaction.
But Josh, what did you think of that?
I didn't see it either. Well, yeah.
Really?
I'm just here
so
to stymie people.
There's old Adam on his own show just talking about. Yeah.
This is usually your role, Michael. You're bringing up the films nobody's seen.
There has been. Can we just talk briefly about the fact that every time we always deride the general cliche pool of the musical biopic. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you look at films like a flawed but very interesting Miles Ahead, the Don Cheadle film, you look at Love and Mercy, a film I really love.
Really good film.
You're really talking about a genre that's
a genre I actually love.
That's clearly rolling. You know, yeah. But not automatically. Tom Hiddleston couldn't really do a damn thing for I Saw the Light. Yeah, I mean Hank Williams, great material, great life story. But yep. the film was.
It is what you do with the material. The choices.
Well, how
you
many
make.
Of those successful ones do something structurally interesting? And I'm thinking particularly of Love and Mercy, and having the with Cusack and Dano both playing Brian Wilson and looking at different periods of his life. It's not the straight A to Z
exactly
chronological approach. That seems just not to work.
And Born
anymore.
To Be Blue very much fitting into that.
Right.
Construct.
Right. I look forward to it.
Okay, good. And I look forward to your reaction. That brings us to our number four films of the year so far. I can't wait to see if you love it as much as I did or if you dash my dreams. Michael, you're number four.
I got 6 months to plot exactly how I'm going to do it. My number four, in 5 months, fellows, I don't know if I'm going to defend this pick. But it may just sort of fly away. Who knows? But it's a six-minute film playing in front of Finding Dory called Piper. Hmm. This is Alan Bellario's short film, which is just utterly beguiling, I think. And in a way, in its way, 6 minutes, it's easier to kind of tell your little story and set your tone. Josh's obsession, obviously, a clear tone. Otherwise, he would have appreciated the invitation. But
clearly,
but it's much easier to kind of like hit it and score it with your 6 minute format than sustain a feature. But I think there's something in the comic touch and the genuine sweetness of Piper that I think indicates a really good career ahead for this director. I really hope so. I loved this film. So that's my number four now. What did you guys think of it, and am I going to look like a schmuck in 6 months?
Well, I started it, but still have 3 minutes left. So,
even in the theater, he couldn't sit still. I got to get out of here.
No, actually.
Adam, the thing came with an intermission. You couldn't even get to the intermission?
I saw Finding Dory while on vacation with my family, but my in-laws got lost coming to the theater because we have never been to a movie in this town, and we showed up late. And
I missed
Piper.
It's unbelievable.
I missed it.
He keeps finding new ones. I'll say that for him.
Wow.
This was astonishing when it came on the screen, and in some ways almost worked against Finding Dory, which continues the visual scheme of Finding Nemo, which at the time was very realistic. So it still looks like it's maybe 15 years ago, and Piper is like light years ahead in terms of realism. And
Although in and of itself, I don't think realism is worth a damn in feature animation.
No, it's what they do with it. Yeah. And what's I thought about Piper is they almost could have made something that was like an imagined nature documentary. It was so realistic and not have had any sort of it's a cutesy story. They go for a cutesy story.
It's a kid learning how to swim, essentially.
Yeah, and it's fine, and it's fun, but it does bring us back into that realm of sort of mawkish childhood storybooks material, whereas before you were just watching a real little bird hopping around on the sand, and there was something exciting about knowing this was made up and completely fictional, yet it looked like you were watching a nature documentary.
And it's just, it's witty,
There's definitely wit to it.
And it's got one of my favorite cuts of the year, which is just after the first big wave hits the bird, that's the piper that's learning how to navigate, just basically negotiate a life built around huge waves coming in, where you see the wave and then there's a cut to the bird on the beach just sort of shivering, a little freaked out at what happened. But it's perfect. I mean, you can't teach a filmmaker how to make that kind of cut. They either have the instinct to do that and get the laugh and get the right kind of laugh, which is funny and gentle.
I'll be very curious to hear and see if this is still on your list by the end of the year.
Number one of the decade.
You guys have now made me hate my in-laws, so thanks for that. Josh?
All right, number four is The Neon Demon, which has been talked about on the show recently, and there's more witches with this pick in a way. I think when I shared my immediate after screening thoughts, that was episode 591, I talked about how it struck me as a modern fairy tale. And the more I thought about Nicholas Winding Refn's movie, this exploration of narcissism that's set in the world of the modeling world of contemporary LA, the more that the fairy tale motif made sense to me. Elle Fanning plays this 16-year-old neophyte who causes a stir when she comes to town out of nowhere, really. And I think the movie's guiding question is something like, what if Little Red Riding Hood was part wolf? As things unfold, that seems to be a real possibility here. Now, whether you buy into that or not, you still have to admit that this is first and foremost an exercise in aesthetic extremism. From the strobe-lit cinematography by Natasha Breyer to the makeup that's overseen by Aaron Ayanian. On the vacation that I just took with the family to New York, we went to an exhibit on high-end fashion at the Met. And there were some amazing out-of-this-world dresses there. And it really made me excited to rewatch The Neon Demon and really focus strictly on the costume design. It's done by Aaron Benach. I mean, that was some stunning stuff. And it struck me then, though I couldn't process it all, that each item being modeled was in some way reflective of the transition that the Fanning character was making or where she wanted to be. And the same thing for the supporting characters. So Neon Demon, it's still playing at very few theaters. This one is not exactly lighting up the box office. So if you have any interest in it at all, get to it as soon as you can.
What's it feel like? What do you mean? To walk into a room and it's like in the middle of winter, you're the sun. It's everything.
Michael, did you have strong feelings about The Neon Demon?
Haven't seen it yet. I can't lie. I'm not going to lie because I didn't review it. It's not like I reviewed it and now I'm telling you on air
I actually didn't see it.
Yeah, that'd be like more of a new... I would save that for the morning shift, you know, for BBC's morning.
Exactly.
I haven't seen it yet. So, no, again, more of a quirk of the schedule than anything. But what about you?
Well, I did see it and I enjoy it, though not quite as much as Josh. The show you referenced, 591, that's also the show where we played my interview with Elle Fanning and Nicholas Winding Refn, had them here in studio. And I thought they were fantastic. I thought they were illuminating and just very pleasant to talk with. So if you haven't already heard that conversation, you can find it at filmspotting.net. My number four film of the year so far, I'm going to have a little bit of help myself here, Josh, from a voicemailer, Mitch Anderson, in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
So my favorite movie of the year so far is the one that I just haven't been able to shake from my mind. It is Krisha, the writing-directing debut of Trey Edward Schultz. The film follows a woman named Krisha who returns to Thanksgiving dinner with her family after being away for 10 years. It's the kind of movie that proves that that old idiom of a movie is what it's about. A movie is not what it's about, it's how it's about it. And Trey Edward Schultz just has this great visual language that he uses, even as a first-time filmmaker, with these swooping cameras, these dynamic shots, visual, this aspect ratio trickery that he uses, and even some switching between film stock that he does. And I'm a firm believer that you don't need to know the story behind the making of a movie to enjoy the movie, but just knowing the real-life story between Trey Edward Schultz and Krisha Fairchild, his amazing lead actress, adds another layer of complexity to this amazing debut film. And it's also only 83 minutes long, so not a moment is wasted, which I definitely appreciate. So, Krisha, my favorite film of the year so far. Really excited to hear your list.
So that's the voicemail I was referencing with my number five pick, Mitch, talking about this film, proving that adage about it's not what the movie's about, but how it's about it. And I think that definitely does apply to this film. I'll say, forget The Witch, the best horror movie of 2016, in parentheses, that I've seen, added parentheses, that in no real way is actually a horror movie, is this film from director Trey Edward Schultz. It's his feature debut. Mitch nailed the plot. Thank you for doing that. It's about a woman named Krisha who attends Thanksgiving dinner with her family. Hasn't seen him in 10 years. They've been estranged, and that's really it as far as the plot goes. She doesn't show up to slowly discover that her family are actually vampires, or they're angry and out to exact some kind of brutal ritualistic revenge on her for not being the ideal mother slash sister slash aunt slash whatever. But the tension is raw and unsettling. There's a sense right from the beginning that everyone is playing as nice as they can and trying as hard as they can, especially Krisha. How much she's forcing herself to behave a certain way really shows you the cracks there in her armor. She's unraveling right from the start, and all we can do is watch. And I think there's a great symbol for that. There's a great metaphor for it in the movie in the form of the turkey. where you're watching it and she's insisting on helping prepare this turkey. And you think you know where it's going. You think that Schultz is setting us up for a certain kind of disaster, and he more or less is, but then he takes it and just amplifies it times 100. It really isn't at all the disaster we thought it was going to be. It's something much more phenomenal. It's a film, as I said, based on the plot. It shouldn't be as intense as it is. It shouldn't be as visually fascinating as it is. It's like Green Room, a confined space movie. It all takes place in this one house or just outside it. But Schultz is really inventive with the camera work and the editing, which, as much as the performances and the situations, really heighten that intensity.
Are you mad at me?
Mm-mm.
For sure?
Mm-hmm.
Honey, you don't have to study business just because it's what they want you to do, all right? You're a very talented filmmaker, and that's what you should be doing with your life.
Mm-hmm.
You have a gift, and don't let people tell you what you can and can't do with your gift.
Mm-hmm.
I want us to be closer, Trey. I want us to have a real relationship.
I do too.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Then why can't you even look at me? Honey, I got my together now, and I'm going to change my life so that I can be closer to you. I'm going to move to Austin. I'm going to live wherever you live, and I'm going to let you live your life. But I just want to be close to you and make up for lost time. Don't you want that? Why will you not talk to me?
If you watch it, you can see touches of Malick, and Schultz has worked with Malick before. There's Altman there. There's definitely Cassavetes in terms of the improvisational feel and the rawness. But at no point does it feel like he's aping any of those directors. It is totally a unique piece of filmmaking. And actually, if I was going to throw one other film out there, well, two, A Woman Under the Influence, the Cassavetes there in terms of the Jenna Rollins character and Krisha here. And then in terms of that just unnerving proceeding, Requiem for a Dream is about the closest movie I could compare it to. So I love Krisha. I love the performance in particular of Krisha Fairchild in that lead role. There's no official release date yet. It's no longer in theaters as far as I know, but I've been told that mid-August is the tentative release date for DVD, Blu-ray, and digital download.
There's a couple of things. Can I jump in?
Please.
I mean, a couple of excellent assessment.
Thank you, sir.
Because it's my number three, for God's sake.
Okay.
But before we get to that, he is making a horror film. That's his next film, I believe, right?
That's right. I've heard that.
And so it's funny that the style and the touches he's been sort of exploring in Krisha, which very craftily, and without sacrificing character or the seriousness of the issue, you can see that he could very well just make a damn good horror.
For sure.
You know, or a thriller of some kind.
Yeah.
Another thing, I think what's the key, and this, it took me two rounds to really catch this, two viewings. The key to the immersive quality of the film for me is that 1 second you are experiencing the film on the main character's discombobulated line of
the
reasoning.
The POV is definitely captured way.
And a millisecond later, you're simply this kind of horrified observer, but you're also a participant. And most movies aren't that deft at toggling that way. Another thing that strikes me is that the film is hardly plotted, as the caller said, and as you said. And often when you get a film or a scenario that could actually make a satisfying and rather densely packed 6 or 10 minute film, when you try to expand it to feature length, then that's when all the challenges and the troubles begin sometimes, because you start taking things in different directions. And here, I think the great thing that Schultz did was he resisted every impulse to kind of really fan out the story and explore a lot of different narrative avenues. It's all really tight. And just like that fantastic turkey, sequence, where the turkey's being served and then it's completely unserved. It's like that moment in The Idiot where, the guy who was dealing with the seizures is saying, please don't have a seizure,
right.
And I'll break that priceless punch bowl over there on the table if I have a seizure. And that's, of course, what happens. But it's got that kind of sick comic suspense to it. And that's the film's got I don't know. I really admired it, and it held up beautifully a second time. So, yeah, I hope more people at least give it a shot, know what they're in for, because it's not a conventional anything.
Mm. Very well said. A great number three pick, Michael. Josh, you're number three.
So I'm the odd man out with Krisha. I will definitely be catching up with that one before the year's end. My number three, I'm going to let another listener, Randy Grimshaw from Stony Brook, New York, introduce it.
Even though I had the opportunity to see this at the end of 2015, I would have to say that The Lobster, which I'm sure is a popular choice among film spotting listeners, is my favorite film of the year. It was my introduction to Yorgos Lanthimos, and since then I watched Dogtooth, which I thought was brilliant as well.
I'm glad that Randy caught up with Dogtooth as well. That's certainly essential viewing in my book. I do like The Lobster, though. Yorgos Lanthimos' latest even better, I think. This is his pitch-black satire of modern mating rituals. Some animal, but mostly human going on here. The three of us reviewed it all together on episode 587, so it's gotten plenty of attention. I'll just add here that I'm still trying to wrap my head around the ending to this one. We've talked about some other movie endings so far. That choice that the Colin Farrell character is seemingly making and how it also relates to the movie's ideas of ritual and romance is just one I still haven't quite figured out in a good way. You know, it's not that it doesn't make sense. It's that there's so many possibilities and all of them to me seem fairly intriguing. One thing's for sure, I mean, looking at my list here, seeing a Yorgos Lanthimos film and a Nicholas Winding Refn film within a few weeks of each other, which is how it worked out here in Chicago, at least, that's a serious way to mess with your head.
It really is. And I'll follow that up with something a lot more on its face, I suppose, something that is probably not as immediately challenging, but definitely a lot of fun. And I'm going to have some voicemail help as well. This is Ian McFarlane in L.A.
It shouldn't have been a surprise that Richard Linklater was able to follow up his pièce de résistance, Boyhood, with another grade-A effort, but I was still taken aback by just how much I enjoyed watching Everybody Wants Them. The film further establishes Linklater's mastery of slice-of-life storytelling, centering on a bunch of bros being bros and, a few pretentious conversations aside, not much else. Movies so light on plot shouldn't feel this defined or insightful, but Everybody Wants Them manages to be both while being a real delight to watch. I had a smile on my face the whole time. I didn't really know where the movie was going, just that I didn't want it to end.
Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, my number three movie of the year. And it's notable that Ian used that word enjoyed and that phrase about smiling the whole time. Sarah in Toronto also wrote in and said, I can't believe that there isn't more love for Everybody Wants Some. It was definitely one of the most purely enjoyable films I've seen in a long time, and I couldn't get the smile off my face for a good week after viewing. Also heard from Jack in Milwaukee. He says, I loved Everybody Wants Some. I went into it wanting a good sequel to Dazed and Confused and left feeling that that's what I got. How great it would be to complete all of Boyhood, enter college, and then be transported through time. I was 7 in 1980 and only wanted to be like my teenage cousins, so Linklater provided that childhood fantasy of mine. Both Ian and Sarah, with that phrase, couldn't stop smiling. That's exactly how I feel about this film. In fact, there's only one movie so far this year where I smiled more during and after, and that's why it's my number one movie of the year, which we'll get to in a little bit. This is another movie that is probably not as audacious visually as Krisha, but in very subtle ways has some grandeur to it. There's a gracefulness with the camera that we talked about during the review suggests to me multiple cameras maybe being utilized at once because it just feels so naturalistic. The whole lay of the house we get in the opening scene, we understand who every character is, every room of this place, and we're going to get to know it even more intimately. We get lots of overhead shots of these characters in their different environments at the different bars, and I haven't really said yet, the environment is this baseball house on a college campus in Texas in the early 1980s. The whole cast is good, but Glenn Powell's Finnegan is my dream best friend. I just want to hang out with this guy. He's always got an angle. He's always saying or doing something hilarious, but he's fundamentally sweet-natured. He isn't out to ruin it for anyone else. And that time warp aspect to it, there is a party shot in this movie where you feel like a character maybe emerged right from the woods in Dazed and Confused and walked into this party 4 or 5 years later. I love the way it connects with Linklater's other movies. And Ian's right. It is insightful. It's not a baseball movie. Josh, we talked about how it's really anthropological. It's fundamentally about these different tribes of people, their codes and their rules. And of course, being Linklater, it's about what tethers you to you, your identity, your perception of your identity, and really trying to become the person that you want to be. And this is that time in your life, that last vestige of that time where you can still define yourself, where you can still experiment and try these different things and figure out the person you really are.
You know, a bunch of dudes jumping around on stage, jerking each other off, you know, in spandex isn't music.
I don't know, man. I kind of like Van Halen.
Well, yeah, Plum, you do. And you know why you do? Because corporate America is shoving something down your throat and making you believe it because that's what they want you to believe. I mean, guys, it's about finding out who you are. In the space in between the notes that they're offering you. I mean, you gotta tune in, man. You gotta tune in.
I Love Everybody Wants Some. It just came out this week. So if you didn't catch up with it, and I'm guessing many of you didn't because it only made $3.9 million at the box office, you can get it on DVD and digital rental now.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. You don't want to always look at the money to tell you any story about any film. But that, you know, this was clearly made to connect with a bigger audience, a mainstream audience. And it just simply...
You get that sense from the trailer. Yeah.
There's something about Linklater's touch that maybe he's just too humane and easygoing a horn dog, you know? You know, because, I mean, in the end, we're talking about... It's a guy movie, but it's a fairly grown-up one, you know, as good a time as it is. I'm eager to see it a second time. I liked it the first time. I'm not quite sure what I was looking for that I didn't get, but it's good enough to see a second time. So, we'll see.
Well, to speak to your point about the advertising, Adam, it feels more like a guy movie in that trailer than it actually is.
For sure.
I think, though it is still a guy movie. And I wonder if that dated it in a way that it seemed, if you haven't seen it, a bit out of place for this day and time, and maybe that meant some people stayed away at the box office. Who knows? I mean, it was certainly a high-profile release for Linklater. I remember seeing the trailers and the posters and tying into Dazed and Confused very deliberately. You would think there would have been some goodwill there. So it's one of those box office mysteries.
We should point out that it's not like Dazed and Confused was the Animal House of its day.
Sure.
I mean, that was another – it was a small, very modest performing, you know, very low budget, a much, much lower budgeted picture than this one. So, I mean, that's the thing. It's like when you're recreating – 1980 now as opposed to recreating 1976 the way Linklater did with Dazed and Confused, it's going to cost more money because it just we're that much farther away. And it's nothing's harder to evoke, I think, than the recent past. And this film really does do it, especially just for the waterbed gag alone.
For sure.
Perfect, you know, if any...
Yeah.
Brought back all kinds of horrible memories.
I know. Yeah. For me as well. And now that I've admitted that, let's break up our guy fest a little bit here with another voicemail, another very special guest, her pick for the number one film of 2016 so far.
Hey, Film Spotting. Genevieve from the Next Picture Show here, calling in to share my favorite film of 2016 so far. With the caveat that I have a huge list of films I still need to catch up on, my number one right now is Dan Trachtenberg's 10 Cloverfield Lane, which was easily the most suspenseful, sort of viscerally exciting theatrical experience I've had this year. I really respect all the different ways, both narratively and stylistically, the film kind of keeps viewers off kilter throughout, right up through the big reveal in the closing moments. Mary Elizabeth Winstead walks a fine line between vulnerable and badass so very well in that lead woman in peril role, and John Goodman's ambiguously villainous performance is pretty much unimpeachable. So, hey, mark that one down as my favorite performance of the year so far while we're at it.
Thank you, Genevieve, for that pick. A movie I did consider for this list before we started taping, we were arguing a little bit about this. Josh, I believe your word was overrated.
Okay, no.
I'm throwing you under the bus.
Completely out of context. A movie I like just fine.
How is overrated out of context?
In relation to all the excitement over it, part of which I enjoyed and was a part of, I think looking back now, I'm going to say it's a little overrated.
You're saying Genevieve made a terrible pick.
That's not exactly what I said, but thanks for positioning
it that way. You did give it a positive review here on the show.
Yes, thanks for backtracking for me.
Thank you to Genevieve for that pick.
Adam, you're like Donald Trump here. You're just changing directions and bullying
people. Talking out of both sides. That's what I do best.
Well, Genevieve and the Next Picture Show, folks, they've got a great pairing, and that show is available now. It's one of my picks, Neon Demon. They're looking at that alongside Dario Argento's Suspiria.
It's so perfect.
I can't wait to give that one a listen. Absolutely.
Especially going with that whole witchcraft motif there. I love that pairing. I haven't had a chance to listen yet, but it is out now, and Suspiria, going back to the old days of film spotting, that was an early split, an early big fight between Sam and myself. He just thought it was the dumbest movie ever made. He's and he's not throwing, necessarily wrong.
He's thrown everyone under the bus here. And Sam can't even defend himself. Wow.
That's true. Okay. We'll see if I can play nicer here as we get to our top two picks here in just a bit.
I've been low, I've been high, I've been sold all my life. I've got nothing left to play. I've got nothing left to say. I'm a black man in a white world. 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 I'm in love, but I'm still sad. I found peace, but I'm not glad. All my nights and all my days, I've been trying to run away. I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man in a white world.
I feel like I've been here before. I feel that knocking on my door. I feel like I've lost everything I had, but I'm not angry, and I'm not mad. I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man.
It's a class 4 apparition. That's okay, she seems peaceful.
My name is Erin Gilbert, doctor of particle physics at...
And cue the hate mail, I guess, because we just played part of the Ghostbusters trailer. Is that still a thing? It apparently is still a thing.
I hope not.
Not our audience, though, of course. Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig in the film that people are now actually seeing this weekend instead of just writing think pieces about. The reviews so far that we've seen are mixed. Do you think that's fair to say, Michael and Josh?
Yeah, interestingly mixed. I haven't seen it myself, but you know, when you look at locally, your Richard Roper, Pan, and nationally, your Manola Dargis, not rave, but you know, a really strong, you know, endorsement of the film, just as a good time. And Paul Feig is a really solid, reliable comedy director. I'm curious, you know.
Okay.
And I still hate everybody who pre-hated it.
Well, you have to.
Yeah.
Well, except I was one of those people, just based on the trailer. I thought was pretty bad, but
you're just a better dressed version of these trolls who've been gunning for it the whole way.
Yeah. Slightly more sophisticated and sensitive, Michael, but but only slightly. Josh, this isn't going to be a Larson Kemp and our family vacation, but it may be a double date.
I think we're going to go that way. Yeah, Debbie wants to see it, so let's take advantage and check it out. We'll be like
Sarah just wants to get out of the house. So.
Well, hopefully she'll still have fun.
Yeah, I think we will, and we will report back to you on how that goes, not the date, but our experience watching the movie on next week's show. We are also planning to discuss the fourth film. It's been a while, Josh. Are we still doing this marathon, our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon? We're going to discuss Suzanne Beer's In a Better World. It was the winner of the 2011 Foreign Language Oscar. You can, of course, check it out and let us know what you think. Better World is available for rent via most digital platforms. You can also get it via Netflix.
A very rewarding marathon so far. So I'm looking forward to getting back into this.
It has been. I am as well. And I think we have three more movies after that. So we need to hop to it. We do have some movie passes to give away. Always fun to do here on the show for our local Chicago listeners. There is an advanced screening of Woody Allen's latest film, Cafe Society. It opens in Chicago next Friday, the 22nd. The advanced screening is on Tuesday, the 19th. It's at 7 p.m. here in downtown Chicago. If you want to go see that film and you want to see it for free in advance of its release, you can enter at filmspotting.net. And I believe we're also giving away, Josh, some passes there for Absolutely Fabulous, the movie. So a couple options to enter now at filmspotting.net. We're going to get back to our top five of 2016 so far in a bit, including listeners' picks, some more listeners' picks for their favorites of the year. But first, we do have a new poll question for you. And this is one of those poll questions that our wonderful co-producer Sam Van Hallgren spent way too many hours thinking about and trying to craft. You can't blame me at all for this one, Josh.
Just the description here.
I know. It's two paragraphs to set it up.
Locked himself in a room this afternoon and would not let himself out until he had this poll question.
Well, here we go. We're looking ahead a couple of weeks to our planned review of Jason Bourne. Paul Greengrass is back. Star Matt Damon is back. And it's hard to believe, but it was almost 10 years ago that they last collaborated on a Bourne film, The Bourne Ultimatum, in 2007. So this got us slash Sam thinking about Greengrass, who had a pretty great first decade of the 21st century. He came on the scene in 2002 with Bloody Sunday, really good film. Followed that up with Bourne Supremacy, United 93, and then Bourne Ultimatum. So who were his peers in the 2000s then? Directors who either made their debuts in the 2000s or they had by far their best decades in the 2000s. Directors who worked primarily or most prominently in big budget studio films and had consistent critical and commercial success.
Okay, I followed him. I know where he's going here.
Okay, so what did he come up with then, Josh, along with Greengrass?
All right, here's who we've got. Alfonso Cuarón. So think of Y Tu Mama Tambien, Harry Potter, Prisoner of Azkaban, Children of Men. Greengrass himself, of course. Then Christopher Nolan. Look at this list. Memento, Insomnia, Batman Begins, Prestige, The Dark Knight, and Steven Soderbergh.
You want a list.
All right. Aaron Brockovich. He was busy. Traffic, Ocean's 11, Solaris, Ocean's 12, The Good German, Ocean's 13, The Informant, plus throw in there Full Frontal, Bubble, Che, and The Girlfriend Experience. That's right. 12 features.
And that was all just by 2003. Okay. That's how prolific
That's
Steven
insanity.
Soderbergh is. So there were some other filmmakers we considered, but I just don't think they were prolific enough to make the cut. Brad Bird, The Incredibles and Ratatouille, Peter Jackson, you've got the Lord of the Rings trilogy, King Kong and The Lovely Bones, and Judd Apatow, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People. You could also throw in the wonderful Andrew Stanton with his wonderful films, Finding Nemo and WALL-E. So Michael, those are the four we went with. Those are the three or four we excluded. Do you think we've got a decent list here, or is this whole question just folly?
Well, it's not. No, it's more than folly. That's a good poll question.
Yeah,
you know,
who won the 2000s?
I mean, I always think, if you look at Soderbergh's list, that's just he's prolific as all get out, and his tastes are fascinatingly rangy, and he knows how to do a good mainstream, you know, commercial picture like Aaron Brockovich, like Traffic, like
Ocean's 11.
The first Oceans.
Yeah.
I don't really care about the other two. But
I'm with you.
Are there flubs? Yes, The Good German, you never want to see it again. But other very interesting experiments like Che and Bubble. All that said, you know, he's not quite the filmmaker that Nolan or especially Alfonso Cuarón is. So I would go Cuarón.
Okay. A good pick there. Josh, you don't have to weigh in now. You can process this and we can get to it in a couple weeks here on the show. I don't think we've actually
processing.
Even fully read the poll question here. We're basically just asking you to pick which of these big budget directors won the 2000s. Who did the best, most consistent, lasting body of work in the decade?
Well,
not
what
the
I'm
most
processing
films.
Is that Inception is 2010. So I know that's not...
Technically?
It's not, but really, it's the same span, and I love that film so much. I love Nolan's films on this list more than any of the others, I guess. So that's going to lead me to go with Nolan, though that is an impressive run by Soderbergh, and Children of Men is, you know, one of the all-timers as well for me. So this is a really tough choice to make, but instinctively, I'm going to go with Nolan.
No, Cuarón. Well, I think you're not pronouncing it correctly.
Is that the problem?
It's Cuarón, not Nolan.
I'm going with Steven Soderbergh for all the reasons Michael mentioned. So thank you for doing all the heavy lifting for me, Michael. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. And if you leave a comment, we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from. Now, there was an addendum to this poll where Sam got to thinking
Sam
even
left
more.
The room, got a snack.
He got a snack,
went
came back
in.
And he was thinking, okay, who were the 2010 equivalents of these directors, big budget studio directors who made the move from the indie world to big budget features, and their artistic credibility remained intact, and they've made really compelling work. The only one, and I spent all of 45 seconds thinking about this earlier today, my apologies to Sam, the only one that came to mind initially is I was thinking of Guillermo del Toro, who made smaller films and then went on to make Pacific Rim, and I don't think Crimson Peak probably qualifies as a huge studio movie. But the flaw with that argument, and there may be many, is that, of course, you go back and look at the budget for at least Hellboy 2. I looked that up today. That was 40 seconds, and that was like $85 million. So
yeah.
He's been trusted with some big budgets
right.
Well before the 2010. So basically, I don't have an answer. Anybody come to mind for either of you?
I've got nothing. And I think I put about 53 seconds in on this today. Initially, I thought maybe one of the Marvel directors, because the superhero films have been handed in some cases to unproven, in Hollywood terms, filmmakers, but really no one that compares to like Nolan. And maybe we just don't have enough time yet, to see that sort of track record.
Okay. Well,
you know, when I look at, I mean, this is a slightly different way to look at a category like that, but when you look at how... I guess Catherine Bigelow's films, when you look at The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, she didn't come from a traditional indie, a long indie period necessarily, because she got money and budgets and, bigger ambitions pretty early on. But that's still the career. That's one of the four or five American directorial careers I follow most kind of eagerly. And, or you look at a guy like Damien Chazelle, who did two films I adore, Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench, very small budget, nobody knows it, made nothing but got some critical acclaim, and Whiplash, which made a lot of noise and made a little money. He's got a new one coming out with Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. It's going to open the Venice Film Festival called La La Land.
Can't wait.
And it's a big, big budget, big screen musical. Who knows if it's going to work? But, I think that's the more traditional kind of career we're talking about here. And maybe Chazelle is the guy with the staying power.
Yeah, there are probably a handful who are on the cusp like that, and we just have to wait and see. Ryan Johnson could be described that way, too. I mean, seeing how Star Wars turns out as well.
Well, that's a good point. With Brick and moving on to... You can't get much bigger than Star Wars Episode Eight.
No, and Looper did the trick for him because he made a kind of a difficult, a tricky, complicated science fiction film that did find a nice big audience. Not huge, but made a nice pile of money for the backers. So that's what you want.
To my loss, he doesn't return my phone calls anymore. So
I never liked
it. It was only a matter of time.
I never liked that guy.
I suppose. He's busy. We'll cut you some slack there, Ryan. So we are going to get to our last couple of picks for the best films of the year so far, but we want to see what a few more listeners like you chose. A couple weeks back, anticipating the show, we asked you to name your best film of the year so far, and we gave you, it looks like, six options and then the ubiquitous other. The choices were Captain America, Civil War, Everybody Wants Some, Hail Caesar, The Lobster, OJ, Made in America, or The Witch. And if you didn't like those options, you could write in your own. So a few of those have already come up here in our 5 through 3 picks. Everybody Wants Some, The Witch, and The Lobster. Josh, how did it come out?
7% in last place for Everybody Wants Some, 8% for OJ, Made in America. The biggest film on this list is right here in the middle with 9% of the vote. That's Captain America, Civil War. Hail Caesar got 13% of the vote. The Witch got 17% of the vote. Other took second place. How about that? With 20%, but winning was The Lobster, 26% of the vote.
How about that? I'm a little bit surprised just because I didn't think enough people saw it.
Had even seen it.
Yeah, you saw a pretty nice split there among these options. 26%, not an overwhelming majority, but the clear winner in this one. Josh, was it your number three or number four pick?
Number three.
Okay. Kate says, although The Lobster, The Witch, and Hail Caesar hold more art house appeal and will therefore probably get more votes from this crowd, at the end of the day, I had to pick Captain America Civil War because its writers pulled off the near impossible. As a screenwriting student, I know how difficult it is to plot out even a 90-minute single protagonist drama, much less establish the ethical motivations of two lead characters, at least four major supporting characters, and up to 12 ancillary allies, and incorporate it all into a 2.5-hour plot, one that's still easy to follow, answers questions from previous movies, and sets up future ones. I can't think of another film this year, or even very many from last year, that demonstrates such efficient storytelling craft, especially when you put it up against that other superhero movie from March that proved less than impressive. It's an incredibly difficult feat, one that will probably get less notice than it should because screenwriters Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely made it all look so easy. A compelling case from the very, very smart Kate Fueyo.
Well, thank you, Kate, for giving me the opportunity to point out something I should have in our original review about those screenwriters. What else did they write, Adam? What fantastic top 10 movie
did they write? Why did we have to read this? Pain and Gain.
Michael Bay's Pain and Gain.
Yeah, those guys are talented. How did you miss that opportunity?
That was like an after-screening review. I didn't even have time to look it up and clearly paid no attention to the credits. We also heard from Stuart in Bondurant, Iowa.
Not far from my hometown.
Really?
Traveled through Bondurant. Used to work in Bondurant.
What'd you do
as
there?
As a college student. I worked at Adventureland.
Adventureland?
Yeah.
How about that?
The amusement park.
What did you do?
My freshman year after college.
That's not specific enough. What did you do there?
I did games. I was not rides. I was games. So I took that Bondurant exit every day of the summer. All of them, Josh. They worked you around the park.
They don't just start you out with the simplest game?
No.
Or they saw you and said, this guy can handle them all.
You got it.
I can see it. Back to Stuart. I was tempted to vote for Captain America Civil War, which was great entertainment and storytelling, but in my view, the best picture of the year so far is 10 Cloverfield Lane. Much was written about the Hateful Eight's use of a single room, but 10 Cloverfield's similar use of a confined setting to generate suspense and tension was even more impressive and effective. Combine that with the strongly written character played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, director Dan Trachtenberg's sure-handed command over plot and tone, and the all-around excellent performances, and you have the best film of 2016 so far.
Though, Josh says, slightly overrated. Stuart agreeing there with Genevieve. Thank you for those comments. Michelle shared some thoughts as well.
Michelle says, although this year has had quite a few solid hits already, many of which are listed in the poll, I had to choose other and go with Green Room. Jeremy Saulnier is quickly becoming one of my favorite new directors. Green Room stuck with me weeks after viewing it, and its brilliance made the recent loss of Anton Yelchin even more tragic. And isn't that true?
That is so true. J.M. Bossy in Vancouver agrees with Michelle, writing, no other film has stayed so potently in my mind. No other sounds, no other images have stayed so vivid. Saulnier stripped his story of every ounce of fat, leaving behind a lean, grisly thriller. I have a feeling I will be saying the same thing for the next 6 months, but whenever applicable, Green Room will be my vote.
We have an other vote here from Sam. I picked Other because Love and Friendship is the best movie I've seen so far this year. This is a con artist movie like The Sting, except transported to a world of manners and gentlemen callers. It's a film that examines both meanness and kindness in equal measure, sometimes within the same sentence. And Kate Beckinsale's ruthless anti-heroine has to be seen to be believed.
I agree with that.
You know, Sam, that's a great defense for that film and a great description of that tricky tone. And it's kind of one I wish I had managed to make room for on my top five.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling like I'm falling apart here.
Honorable
Piper,
mention
you're
for
losing
me.
Piper, aren't you?
Piper's out. I just found out it was a short film. I didn't realize. George says, I'm going with Swiss Army Man. It's one of the most original, most laugh out loud, funny, most audacious, most assured, most insightful, most memorable, and most enjoyable run-on sentences. I'm sorry, most enjoyable films I have seen in a long time.
That's a lot of superlatives.
That's all right, Evie. He feels what he feels. The thing that really sold me on the entire movie was its ending. It takes a turn that I did not expect and was totally brave and true to the film's spirit. I loved every minute of this crazy thing, and I'm still singing Montage days after seeing it. I really hope Adam enjoyed it as much as I did or had at least something close to my exuberant experience with it.
So, of course, this comment then came in before last week's show where Melissa and I reviewed Swiss Army Man and didn't have nearly enough exuberance for it. Appreciate a lot of the same things that George did, though the ending was actually one of the big problem areas for me with Swiss Army Man. Though,
same.
Yeah, okay, so I'm not alone there. I did see some people commenting on this over at the Film Spotting Forum. We have a great message board, super smart listeners, and some non-listeners who just like to come over there and talk about cinema, and they were responding to my comment that I didn't laugh very much at it, which was a question from Melissa. That's fine. There are some very funny lines, but I didn't laugh that much, and then I admitted that, well, I did see it on a Sunday morning, and actually it might have even been the Monday morning of July 4th. I saw it that Monday.
It's our national holiday.
I'm watching the Farting Corpse movie, as you do. And up until 2 minutes before it started, I was the only person in the theater. And then two people came in. So I only saw it with three people. And it's maybe hard to laugh that much when you're not having that communal experience. And people in the forum were saying, I saw it with a huge crowd. People were dying. They thought it was hilarious. Hmm. So who knows? Maybe I would have had
and
a different
Sundance
experience.
Sundance walkouts at a screening or two, right? Weren't there?
I don't know. I don't know. Sam did say that, and I regurgitated it here on the show, but I didn't hear that myself. But then again, I don't follow the trades.
I heard people were killed there. Is that not true? No?
Let's just keep going.
Well, thank you to everyone who voted in the poll. Thank you to everyone who left a comment. Let's get back into our picks for our best films of 2016 so far. We have number one and number two left, and we are going to get the help of another member of the wonderful Next Picture Show podcast. She is Tasha Robinson.
So far for me, 2016 has already been a really interesting year for smaller, more distinctive films with a really specific point of view and style, like Green Room, Hunt for the Wilder People, King Jack, The Lobster, The Fitz, and American Fable. But the one small-scale film that's really stuck with me is Robert Eggers' writing and directing debut, The Witch. The film was billed as a really scary horror story in an attempt to sell it to a mass theater audience, which did it a disservice because so many people showed up with the wrong expectations. Now that it's on home video, I'm hoping people will find it and appreciate it for what it actually is, a perfectly realized personal story about religious awe and dread and about what drives people's choices, especially when they feel like they don't have any choices at all. But it isn't the message that resonates with me so much about The Witch. It's Robert Eggers' perfect control of mood and image. The cinematography in this film is so striking and beautiful. The lighting is amazing. The sound design is incredibly creepy. The cast is perfect, and they make some very difficult Baroque period language feel natural. And the tone is just so weighty and solemn and intense. This is an incredibly well-planned and executed film, and as creepy and tragic as it is, it's still immersive in all the best ways. It's the kind of thing I most hope for when I walk into a theater, the chance to be completely caught up in somebody else's dream in a perspective I've never seen before, built so convincingly that it stays with me for a long time after I walk away. I hope more people catch The Witch, and I hope critics remember it when the end of 2016 rolls around.
So Josh Larson's number five film of the year, listener Joshua Solomon's number one, and Tasha Robinson's number one film of the year. It may just get a little bit more love here as we work through our final two picks. So enough said for now. Michael, your number two film of the year so far that is not The Witch.
Okay. You know, guys, I really fell for Zootopia. Okay.
Really?
I did.
Wow.
Now, I don't know. Again, 6 months from now, we'll see if it's still on the list. But that's a film from Disney, not Pixar, but from Disney, that had the most Pixarian sort of level of invention, and it's just sort of interesting and stimulating kind of variations on genres. It's basically a cop movie, a detective film. It's sort of a great sly examination of where we are in terms of how fear mongers tend to run the political discourse in this country. And I just found it really, really clever, sprightly, well plotted, and a genuinely good, strong protagonist. Good voice work. It's nothing visually groundbreaking. You can say that against it. But that doesn't really necessarily rule any film out. I mean, a lot of films, animated or no, don't have any kind of style that really trumpets its own invention or clever, you know, or mm-hmm. or even strategy, really. But that's it's good. I really fell for this thing.
Excuse me? Down here? Hi.
O.M. goodness. They really did hire a bunny.
What?
I gotta tell you are even cuter than I thought you'd be.
Ooh, you probably didn't know, but a bunny can call another bunny cute, but when other animals do it, it's a little...
I am so sorry. Me, Benjamin Clawhauser. The guy everyone thinks is just a flabby donut-loving cop stereotyping you. Oh.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, it's a good movie. It's definitely clever, and you're right. It feels like somehow it was made with this election cycle and one candidate in particular in mind, and that's all I'll say.
Right. Yeah, it's politically on point, and the only thing you do wonder, and thinking about it the further I get away from it, is how that holds up, you know, or is that something where it's that spark of recognition where we see, oh, how did this movie get it?
But there's
almost no way
they did it intentionally.
Exactly. There's an excitement to that, and I wonder if that'll wear or eventually it'll be more.
But I'd say it's a different amount and a different level of that kind of subtle political commentary than a movie like The Purge 3, which I actually enjoyed. And it's like hilariously blunt about using Trump and Hillary Clinton as character archetypes. You know, is that going to work in 6 months? I don't know. But I think Zootopia will hold up.
Yeah. Jennifer Goodwin there with some great voice work, as you mentioned, Michael, as Judy Hopps, the main character. But you've got Jason Bateman and Idris Elba and Jenny Slate, J.K. Simmons, Octavia Spencer. Really good ensemble there, doing some very nice work. Josh?
My number two is Cemetery of Splendor. This is the latest from Thai director Apichit Pong Rastakun, whose only previous film I've seen is Uncle Boon Mi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives. Now, that one I admired, but mostly from afar. There were just a ton of cultural references that I had no connection with, so it kept me from being able to really access it in a way that it probably should be appreciated. I found Cemetery of Splendor more approachable, and it's probably partly because it has a fairly basic storyline, a mysterious one, but a clearly understood one. It's about a volunteer who's serving some 24 soldiers at this rural hospital where they're suffering from a mysterious sleeping sickness. On my site, I wrote at length about the way the movie evokes and I think melds three states of being: waking life, dreaming, and remembering. I'm not going to get into all of that here, but I do want to mention how one of Rastakun's most indelible images evokes this idea. There are these futuristic breathing machines that stand beside each soldier's bed, and they're about 6 foot tall tubes that glow, and they gradually change color from, you know, white to pink to red to blue. And it's just this astonishingly eerie and just a beautiful shot that we get at one point of 12 of these lined up all in a row, and they cast this choreographed glow across the room. The film returns to this in different ways throughout, and at one moment even borrows the way it tints the screen for an exterior nighttime scene. That's just like anything else I've seen. I think this is going to be one of those movie images that will define 2016 for me, definitely, when it's all said and done. This is available now on streaming. It played the festival circuit for well over a year. Got a theatrical release here in the U.S. earlier in 2016, but you can see it streaming now. I watched it on Amazon.
Yeah, it was probably second in line for me behind The Witch, and I just wasn't able to get to it. I'm with you on Uncle Boon Mee. I think we probably had similar reactions. I was wowed by it at times, just astonished looking at some of the imagery, but also found it maybe a little too dense to really latch onto. I don't know, Michael, where you are with Joe's work. I prefer to call him Joe because I can't pronounce his name the way Josh can.
Yeah, well, we're buds. And in fact, that's the name he goes by. And
right.
And he came out of the...
Josh likes to show off.
As we know, he came out of the School of the Art Institute, too.
Right.
He's a Chicago guy. But I've seen Uncle Boomy twice. I really love that. I haven't seen Cemetery of Splendor yet. I managed to miss it at a couple of festivals. Definitely going to see it before the end of the year.
Okay. My number two film of the year, and yes, I am calling it a film. Well, I'm not going to give you the answer here. Actually, Scott Tobias is going to reveal it. It's his favorite movie of the year.
Hi, Adam and Josh. This is Scott Tobias from The Next Picture Show. There's no clear winner for me for the first half of the year. Any other day, I might put Hail Caesar at the top or Hong Sang-soo's Right Now, Wrong Then. But today, I'm going with Ezra Edelman's documentary O.J. Made in America. After watching the FX series American Crime Story, the People vs. R.J. Simpson, I thought I'd pretty much learned enough about the Simpson trial and all of the themes of race, class, sexism, and celebrity that went along with it. But O.J. Made in America proved me wrong. The director spends 3 hours setting up the context of L.A.'s racial history and O.J.'s personal history before he even gets to the murders. That really won my respect. And the film that follows is just packed with insights and revelations from there. It's just a really powerful, prismatic experience. ESPN broke it up into 5 parts, but it's really just riveting however you watch it. I totally recommend it. So, O.J. Made in America.
Scott, of course, another voice from the Next Picture Show podcast. It's almost like we know how to cross-promote here on Film Spotting. I don't know how any of this happened, but thank you, Scott, for that pick. And we did get a few commenters in our poll question wondering why that movie, which we did add to the poll that wasn't initially there when we listed our options. They're wondering how it was eligible. And the fact is, it just is. People are considering it a movie. It's going to be up for Oscar contention. It's eligible because it did have a theatrical run, even if I think it was only on one screen or at one theater. But it is a 5-part, 7.5-hour series that was spread out over those 5 nights on ABC and ESPN. But people have viewed it theatrically as 1 7.5-hour film. And unlike Scott, I did not watch the FX series. So I came in feeling like I knew very little about OJ except what I remember from it. And Ezra Edelman made me realize that I knew even less than I thought I did about all the twists and turns, the bizarre twists and turns, and the personalities involved, but especially about how O.J. was certainly and remains certainly a microcosm for this country's struggle with race and class and, yes, as Scott said, celebrity too. I think it belongs on this list for the quality of its documentary filmmaking and for how riveting it was as drama over the course of those 5 episodes and 7.5 hours. It never gets dull, but for these lists, occasionally, I like to talk about movies or think of my picks as movies that maybe fit into a little bit of a time capsule. Are they representative of something from the year? Are they films that we should look back on later that tell us something about the time in which we live. And I could go off here, and I won't, about the Chuck Klosterman book I'm reading right now, But What If We're Wrong, where he tries to visualize the world we live in as it will look to people in the distant future, looking back on this as the distant past. I'll save all that chatter maybe for the end of the year when OJ Made in America makes my list, but it's not only one of the most essential movie experiences of the year. And if you are able to make the time, I would suggest that I can't imagine anybody having an issue devouring all 7.5 hours. If you can do it, I think the movie will reward you for it, and you'll find that it's thrilling in that way and eminently watchable, but it's also a movie that very clearly informs so much of what's happening right now in our country. And I mean literally right now, as we're taping this a couple days after Dallas and Minneapolis and Baton Rouge. It feels timely and sadly timeless as well. And it taught me so much. And, you know, as we've all seen probably, for those of us who are on Facebook, we see various friends and family members chiming in for better or for worse about some of these events. And there are so many of them I really do, without any sense of condescension at all, I really want to say to them, can you make time to watch this 5-part OJ series? Because I really think you would understand a lot of this so much more clearly and maybe have a little bit more empathy if you watch this series.
Yeah, because it's a macro view, right, and a micro view at the same time. And I say that having only watched FX's People versus OJ Simpson. But from what I understand, they take similar approaches, different, you know, styles, obviously.
But that's all about the trial, isn't
well,
it?
Well, but the scope is wide, sure. Similar in the fact that it starts with the Rodney King situation
so
as well.
So that's covered a lot
so
here.
So it's definitely showing how, you know, this was a microcosm for a lot of things in our country's history. And you're right, to be exploring that now is crucial.
Yeah. And if you haven't seen it and want to catch up with it, you can stream it via ESPN. If you Google it, you'll find the links. You do, I believe, have to have a cable provider in order to log in and see it. But unless this information is incorrect, it says it's coming out July 19th. So 1 week away here, or just a couple days after this show will go up, it should be available on DVD. I hope that's right.
I hope so. And I haven't, ethically, I couldn't include it because I haven't seen the whole thing. And I think it's, for every reason you just said, Adam, you're uncharacteristically correct about everything.
I'll take it.
Yeah. But it's been a very hard few months, guys, I think, to even look at essentially theatrical film without feeling like the bigger cultural noise and the more urgent matters are being handled mostly on television and in real life. I mean, when the film of the year, honestly, is probably the Facebook video that went viral out of the suburban Minneapolis shooting, we're in a, I don't want to reduce it to simply calling it a news cycle, but we're living in an extended, fraught, anguished news cycle that demands our attention. And, you know, when you have real life characters like the Dallas police chief saying everything in a way and just basically calling out every politician in the country saying, what the hell are you doing? Do something. You know, these are compelling protagonists that so often the movies themselves pale, you know, in comparison. And, you know, haven't you found that it's been almost a little difficult to focus on, you know, the usual?
Maybe so. Yeah, of course, definitely is.
In this city especially, in Chicago, because, I mean, we've got so many of our own damn problems right now.
And maybe
now.
That's why as we get to our number one picks, I went with something as frivolous and carefree.
Maybe
and
that's it.
Something
exactly.
That made me just feel so good. Maybe that's why I went with
it. Well, because the movies feel so disconnected a lot of times to current events because there's a lag, right, for a movie to respond. And sometimes it doesn't result in the best movie to respond to a particular time in history. You need something like the OJ documentary that was made separate from any of the current events
yeah,
that speaks directly.
That actually ties in with the Klosterman stuff for sure.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
All right, we are at our number one picks, best film of the year. Michael, what do you have?
The Witch. We've talked about it a few
times.
More
Witch.
And it doesn't speak to the present really directly, although I think in some ways it does because we're always dealing with.
There's a lot of fear.
We're always dealing with fear and repression and the puritanical roots of so much of this country's society and mores. And I think Robert Eggers just simply made an exquisite period piece on very little money and a uniquely unnerving storyline. And I love how divisive this movie is. I got so damn much hate mail on this one. And it absolutely.
For liking this.
For like, people were like, you know, just you personally pay me back for the recommendation. and it did, in fact, chime with the, you know, what we know as the CinemaScore exit polling, which was, you know, Z minus. I mean, it was awful. People hated it. And I think it's because of what we talked about earlier. It's that ending. That ending that gets it's a more literal, a slightly less mysterious form of kind of putting a button on the story. I was with it, but I haven't seen this one a second time yet, so we'll see. And that'll determine where it ultimately lands on my top 10 at the end of the year. But, yeah, it does make a shift that not everybody likes and a lot of people hate. A lot of people hated it from the beginning. You know, I think Eggers is a master. Already, one film, he's a master.
There's a sense of control to it that's undeniable. And you see that in a young filmmaker right away. And it's astonishing, right? Because it's something that you think usually needs years and multiple films to be worked out on. And there's not a frame in this picture that he does not have complete control over. You may not like what he decides to put in it at the ending, but he has complete control over every element.
Also, have you seen Robert Eggers' beard? It's fantastic. He's got like...
I have seen a shot,
it's like the Smith Brothers cough drops guy. ZZ Top and Henrik Ibsen. I mean, it's he's got a...
That's impressive. So, as I suggested earlier, I did catch up with The Witch. I watched it last night in preparation for this show. I wish I was as enthusiastic as you guys and so many people are. I'll say this. I'm one of the people who isn't fond of the ending, but I had some issues before that. Ooh. I love all the performances. Hmm. The performances in this film, especially from the children in this movie, the brother, the sister, Thomason, who's essentially the main character of the film, and then the two younger
kids. Everybody's great. So creepy.
I've never seen child performances probably that good and that creepy before, but not in a creepy horror movie kind of way.
No.
Just in a,
so
they
what's
really
your,
just, they unsettle
there's
you.
There's something
what's,
off about
what's
them.
Your, what's your resistance
I'll
point?
Say this too. I have not been able to come up with a great way to articulate it. I respect that it reveals the mystery. Josh, you said this. It reveals the mystery of the witch right away.
Yep.
There's no spoilers there. So it really is not about that. It's about us suffering through this ordeal with this family. And we know more than them, which is always kind of fun to watch them just implode when we know what's really going on or think we do. But I guess I felt like there really was no mystery to it because I never felt a real surprise at how any characters in the movie behave, how they behave in light of all the horrors that they've seen and are part of and all this chaos. They behave exactly how I think the characters from the very beginning were prescribed to believe. And it's not The Crucible. It's definitely not. We'll say that. It's not about hysteria. It's not about unfounded fear. But it's, of course, not really about the founded part of that fear either. That feels a little bit more like just an afterthought or something for us to laugh at a little bit.
I think that's the trick to it, though.
To be horrified by just in a moment, to be titillated by. I don't know.
But I think
it was hurt by the fact. Let me throw this disclaimer out there.
Right.
Hurt by the fact, no doubt, that I watched it on demand. I did not watch it in a theater, obviously. But I also didn't watch it on iTunes or watch it on DVD where I could have put on the subtitles. Maybe it's just me. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's something about my ear and it's just not as good at picking up that English accent.
Well, you're from Iowa, right?
I am from Iowa. Yeah. So, you know, again, no culture here whatsoever. Right. I really do feel like, Josh, I probably understood about 40% of the dialogue.
Thomason, take the children outside.
What does this to me? What does this? His mouth is sealed up. Mm. Oh, God. William. William. Mm.
Hold it. Children, away from this. Thomason, now.
He'll break his jaws.
And the language, it's just the words themselves that they use, let alone the accent. So I can see that. But the thing you're mentioning about, I see what you mean about what's the threat we're supposed to be worried about or not even worried about, but cluing in here thematically maybe. And the fact that we don't quite know, I think, is one of its really impressive tricks because there's evil both without and within.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, to me, it put me doubly on edge because this family was doomed even if that witch had never shown up. And then you throw the witch in there, and that's where things start getting...
That's a fascinating, provocative question. I'm not sure I think I have the same answer as you, but it's a great question.
Yeah.
It's something to think about.
I would question your characterization of the tone, though, because I think it's not really like an easy, cathartic horror film, and it's a stern, pretty harsh number, and I think that's disorienting for people who like it and don't like it, because it's more than a little sad to watch the story sort of churn through all the machinations and how this family kind of eats itself from the inside out, and it's trust and betrayal and sexual awakening. It's all in this stew in this remote corner of early America, and I don't know, I think it's worth a second look.
Yeah,
I think
it is, too. Yeah, yeah. And I would recommend it just for the performances, honestly. And yes, the control, and I think the tone of it and the way Eggers handles it is impressive, but the performances really were key for me. Josh, your number one film of the year?
Okay, so my number one is Hail Caesar, one of our poll options.
What?
And yeah, this is another argument for the Coens' broad comedies, which this is one of their broadest, I'd say. I find that they can be as profound as their sober-minded dramas, and I think that's what's going on here. It was written off by many, even those who liked it, as this light and enjoyable homage/spoof to 1950s Hollywood. Certainly, it is that, and can be enjoyed on those terms, but I think there's a lot here, and I'm looking forward to digging into a second viewing to look at this more about ideology versus soulless entertainment, or let's say rigid ideals versus ruthless commerce, maybe playing with the tension there. Hail Caesar, it just argues for something that's in between those two, something that's pure and simpler, something like Hobie Doyle just doing a perfect lasso trick in one of my favorite scenes. We talked about how Karina Longworth profiled Eddie Mannix. That's the studio fixer who was the model for Josh Brolin's main character here. She talked about Eddie Mannix on her first season of You Must Remember This, her podcast. As I've been catching up on the current season, which is about the Hollywood blacklist, it seems like that's just as applicable to what's going on here. And
Before, I think, was more MGM stories. So literally back to back, it set the table for Hail Caesar.
And everything that is coming up on those episodes, you can see playing out in some comic literal ways in the foreground, but also more ideologically in the background. So Hail Caesar is out now, streaming it and on Blu-ray. I've got a copy at home. Can't wait to dive in for a second viewing.
So Michael, not a fan. I'm a big fan. It just missed my top five.
Yeah, really?
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'll give it another look, guys. I think it's an
interesting. That's all we can ask.
It's an intriguing, I think, sort of encoded self-portrait of the Coens' actual viewpoint on what they do for a living. I think they just appreciate, you know, honest, no BS craftsmanship and not taking yourself or, you know, the industry or anything too seriously. And, you know, the proofs and the work. And I think that's how they see Eddie Mannix as their kind of their hero. I guess one thing I resisted, and maybe it's an invalid resistance point, is the real Eddie Mannix was so much more dynamic and bizarre and ruthless and venal and kind of a controversial figure than basically
Brolin makes him likable.
Brolin is much,
sure.
much
so I just wrote that off completely.
Yeah, much closer to, I mean, it's a fiction. I even questioned, well, why base him on a real guy then? Because it's not.
Why use the name?
Why use the name? Yeah, just,
but
you know,
that's the Coens, right? Fargo, true story, not a true. I mean, it just feels playful
in that
way.
Yeah, I suppose so. But to me, I guess it's so much a come down from the movies of theirs I really adore, like A Serious Man. But again, I'll see it again for your sake, Josh.
Well, thank you.
Only for yours.
All right. Before we get to my number one film, we have one more guest voicemailer, and I wanted to be sure to play this because this pick for the number one film of the year is a movie that has not been referenced yet on any of our lists or in our poll question. This comes to us via Allison Wilmore. It says here she's on a podcast called Film Spotting SVU.
Haven't heard of that one.
No.
I've got a few favorites so far in 2016, but the one I keep coming back to again and again is Wiener, Josh Krugman and Elise Steinberg's documentary about the disgraced New York Congressman Anthony Weiner, who turns out to be the perfect documentary subject in that he never says no to the cameras, even when it seems like he really should.
Allison Wilmore going in a direction I love with a documentary for her top pick, Weiner, the Anthony Weiner documentary. Now, Josh, I don't think you saw this one, right? But Michael, you have.
I have.
And I have, and I haven't had a chance to talk about it on the show. I was really hoping that we actually would have found the time to review this one just so it really would have forced me to crystallize my thoughts. But I had a pretty mixed reaction to it, actually.
Surprising.
It's exhilarating to watch. He's a human train wreck. You can't avert your eyes, so of course that's exhilarating. And you have access to that train wreck that is rare, if not completely unparalleled, in documentaries. But a lot of people have praised it for how it handles his wife, Huma Abedin. But for me, she's mostly a passive-aggressive presence. She's always either sighing or she's leaving a room or she's closing a door. They don't talk to her. She speaks up a few times, but I'm guessing she said, I don't want to be interviewed on camera, and that's her choice and that's fine. But I think that does ultimately really hurt the movie. And there are a couple rhetorical touches in a few scenes that honestly drove me bonkers, where Wiener in two different points is out campaigning and they really ramp up the music, the non-diegetic music that amplifies his charisma with the editing.
Easy irony.
Oh, easy irony. They try to make him look so charismatic while making his opponent, de Blasio, at this point, look really pathetic. And I have a feeling that they actually could have just let the footage speak for itself, and it would have shown that, too.
And nothing,
but they can't stop themselves.
I mean, the film's entertaining in that sort of rubbernecking way, you know. But it's I agree with you on every point. I think this film, even though it's entertaining in many ways, it flunks the sort of fly-on-the-wall test deliberately. You know, it's one of those things where the director's camera and the director's off-screen commentary occasionally intrudes in such a way you just feel like it's starting to affect the experiment rather than recording it. And mm-hmm. I know there's a million ways to handle the directorial presence and the camera presence in any documentary. But to me, I there's that moment in Wiener where, you know, Anthony Wiener in the back of a limo on the way to another failed campaign stop just is kind of sick of the camera and sick of the nattering questions of the guy behind the lens. And he just says, look, you know, aren't these guys supposed to be flies on the wall? And it gets it gets a really good laugh. But it kind of cuts to the major flaw of an entertaining but kind of shallow picture.
I agree.
Nice work, guys. Allison's never going to leave another
voice. Never. I know. Here I am being mean again. Like, I'm just tearing people down. I
take
apologize.
It back. I like Allison more. I take it back.
I love Allison. I'm mixed on Wiener. And that brings us to my number one film of 2016 so far. I do not have any voicemailers to criticize or to praise, but I do have a couple listener comments here. And Billy Ray Bruton in Los Angeles, California is going to do the honors, because I agree with him. My favorite film of 2016 thus far would have to be John Carney's magnificent Irish coming-of-age tale, Sing Street, which takes the music, fashion, and cultural upheaval of the 1980s in Britain and transforms them into the sweetest, most inspiring love story to come around since, well, the last time John Carney directed a film. Well, let's go back to once, maybe not begin again. Everything about this film rings as genuine, and I've had more fun recommending it to friends than any film in recent memory, and no one has yet been disappointed. I have a fear this film was going to be forgotten as the year progresses, but everyone should experience it and leave the theater just like I did, singing these fantastic original songs. Jonathan Griffin also wrote in, although I've loved all the films that were in your poll question, I have to go with Sing Street for my best of 2016. The way this film subtly captured the joy of creative endeavor with the music and the way it formed a dynamic viewing of the search for identity, especially during one's high school years, drew me in all the way. But what really got me was the story of brotherhood in the midst of a broken home and a broken community. The way the older brother had lost something but loved his brother so much that he became a mentor to help him find what he himself never could. I left the theater in tears. Not to mention the perfect use of music, the melancholic cinematography, and the pitch-perfect acting. I will revisit this film for many years to come. So apparently what brings a smile to my face are movies set in the 80s. If you go back to Everybody Wants
Everybody Wants Some and
Sing Street, that did occur to me here today. But I think that there are, as a couple of the listeners there touched on, there are a lot of potential ways in to this movie. It could be the music. It could be the coming of age aspect. It could be the love story or the family story, especially that dynamic with the older brother. Every single one of them worked for me. And the main one was the music. This is original music. This is about a kid. You've heard it a little bit here in the description, but a kid 14 or 15 years old goes to a new school, wants to impress a girl, has some musical aspirations already, decides, I'm going to form a band basically so he can make a music video so that he can then cast her.
And this is in the early days of music videos.
Exactly,
so
the very, very early days. It really is great stuff. But the songs were written and composed by an 80s veteran, Gary Clark, and he worked with Carney and a couple others who definitely know what they're doing. This music is derivative in all the right ways and yet is very catchy and very listenable. And it's not just these are some kids fooling around. They all know how to play, and they're playing some really good tunes. And for me, the best scenes in the movie are when he'll go sit with his brother, and his brother will play him something like Hall & Oates, or he'll play him Duran Duran or The Cure. And then the next scene is them practicing, and he's written a song that sounds vaguely like,
yeah, like The Cure,
Hall & Oates, or The Cure, or Duran Duran.
She's standing on the corner like an angel in disguise. And as I look a little closer, she's got dangerous eyes. She tells me she's a model, of international reputation. She's lacking in a bundle, but there's a stipulation.
I did just mention there, if those all weren't ways in for you, the other way in, if you're a fan of movies like Be Kind Rewind or Son of Rambo, which I love, this band does produce their own music videos, and they're just as inventive and as fun to watch as the music is, I think, to listen to. And I think Carney, he ups his game visually, too. There are two great performance sequences in this movie, one that's pure fantasy in the school gym, and the other showing the band practicing a song through the night, and then the camera doesn't give us a clear transition. It just takes us on into the next day, maybe even beyond that, as if they've now been regularly practicing this tune and really honing it. So, you know,
that second one is great.
Oh, it's,
I think,
so good.
That's
the fantasy
great
sequence.
That's,
yeah,
great. Like the best of Once, which I loved Once. Really, and this is delightful.
I mean, look,
this could roll back on my top 10 by the end of the year. It was a great time. I don't like the last 15 minutes. But
really?
Nah.
Well, if we wanted to spoil it, we could talk about it.
Let me tell you what happens at the end.
I have.
No, I'm
please
not
gonna, don't.
No,
please
I,
don't,
I do
haven't
have.
Seen it.
You haven't seen it yet?
No.
Oh, yeah, check
I
it out.
I can see how the end of the film doesn't work for some people, and I've seen a few comments on Letterboxd to that effect, but what I think is making people a little uneasy is actually what I really appreciate about it. So a discussion maybe for another time, but it is a movie that's in my wheelhouse as far as being a portrait of the artist as a young man or young woman. And I did notice, and I certainly never do this, I didn't set out, there was no agenda here, but as I was thinking about this pick and thinking about portraits of the young artist, all of my choices actually do have this theme of art and identity, going back to Born to Be Blue, a trumpet player, this new clean version of himself as a musician and as a person, and the struggles with that. Krisha, the new clean mother, this really fractured sense of identity, actually has a character in the movie played by the filmmaker Trey Edward Schultz, playing a character who makes films named Trey. And everybody wants some, even, right? This baseball player, he's going off to college, discovering the punk scene, discovering how much he enjoys going to the theater parties. He's Richard Linklater, right? So he's discovering this artistic side of himself. I don't know that I'll make the case for OJ unless we want to include the Naked Gun and some of those roles that he played. But as far as a person who essentially at every stage of his life was an actor, constantly playing a version of himself, the key line in that movie that someone says that OJ said to him is, "I'm not black, I'm OJ," right? He's a character, and he's always playing that OJ character. So just a theme I noticed running through my films, and Sing Street, I guess, was the pinnacle of those films about art and identity for me this year. And hopefully I've sold it to you and you want to see it if you haven't already. It comes out on DVD July 26th.
Its fans are, they sound like you do. I've been hectored to see this one more than any other picture. And I think I just missed that window because it's out of theaters now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm glad it's going to be
back in for a weekend and that's it.
And it's a bummer that it didn't find, in the first round anyway, in its first life, it didn't find the audience that Once found. Because
and that's like it could have if it had been given the chance.
Yeah, wonder if that had come first, Adam, you know, would Sing Street have created the same sort of stir and delight that Once did? I don't know.
That's a good question.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, those are our top five films of 2016 so far. Michael, were there any films that have been mentioned or you want to remind us of? I know Love and Friendship was a big one.
Yeah, so many. Exactly. These were all very good and all, you know, for whatever it's worth, got 3.5 out of 4 for me. You know, things like The Lobster, Sing Street, as you said, a Sunset Song. I guess you always wait for the handful of movies that pops up above that very good level. And and I guess the older I get, the more I do kind of reserve the right to see what the 6 months does to reorder these things in your mind and as what a second viewing does for any number of movies.
Yeah, these are not in stone. We put out the disclaimer
I like
all
that.
The time.
Yeah, no, and I used to get all kind of nervous about that, but now I don't. But no, it's even if the year has felt a little weak so far overall, and it does feel like everything from OJ to, you know, to everything that's actually kind of plaguing us in real life, mm-hmm. whether we're watching it on small screens or just sort of living in the ether of it all, and a lot of bad news locally and nationally. I look forward to the second half of the year.
Yeah.
I've got a bunch of titles that would be on my top 10 list if I had to make it right now, sort of fighting for spots. Green Room has been mentioned. That would probably be on there. April and the Extraordinary World, we reviewed on the show. I really enjoyed Last Days in the Desert, the documentary Pervert Park. I was a big fan of Captain America Civil War. Right now, that'd probably be on my top 10. Then also Midnight Special from Jeff Nichols. Hmm.
So that was one I thought was going to go unmentioned because every other honorable mention for me has been mentioned up to this point. I love it when these lists aren't hard to make, and for me it wasn't. The five films I mentioned were very clearly for me my five favorite of the year, but the ones behind it in alphabetical order, and again, almost all these have been said. Actually, they all have now. 10 Cloverfield Lane, Green Room, Hail Caesar, The Lobster, Love and Friendship, Midnight Special, and Sunset Song. There are some regrets. Now, Michael, we heard some of the films here that you haven't caught up with yet this year. Josh, same with you, and Cemetery of Splendor, the big one for me. But any other films that you know you have to catch up with and feel a little bit bad that you didn't before doing this?
I said I was going to see Popstar, and it was gone. I had one or
movie.
Two weekends to see that, so
funny
I'm
movie.
Definitely going to see Popstar.
Another one where the hate mail I got on the Popstar review. Which
for going
I,
against
I,
it or
no,
for
no,
recommending
I liked
it?
No, I like that film. I don't love it, but I like it. And that was people felt beaten up by the profanity and the nudity and all the rest of it, and it just isn't for everybody. But
well,
you know what?
You sold me even more, Michael. So
that's your big regret, Josh.
I have been meaning for a while now to catch up with Embrace of the Serpent. This was Columbia's Oscar nominee for foreign language film from last year. So I know that is on Amazon now, so there's nothing holding me back. Also, Mountains May Depart is Giazhanka's latest. And then Sing Street obviously is on there. And The Fitz is an independent film about an 11-year-old tomboy who joins a dancing troupe. That sounds very intriguing. I'm not sure where that's at. I think it may still be coming to Chicago. Mm-hmm. I know it's played a number of festivals. So,
Sing Street, actually, you're forbidden to see.
What does that mean?
You're forbidden to see it because it has barely 3-star Josh Larson review written all over it. And it will crush me. It will crush me. It will affect our relationship. The show will be canceled.
I really enjoyed Once. Does that make you feel better about allowing me to see Sing Street?
Maybe, yeah.
Big
it does.
Fan of Once.
It helps.
I mean,
it helps.
A small chance I'll like it as much as you did, but I might enjoy it.
But is it going to piss him off if you like it more? You know,
I'll be good with that.
Oh, really?
With that.
Really?
Now you're that's a good
enjoying
idea,
enjoying it is what I'm afraid of. That's what I'm afraid of, Josh. Well, we did get some other great listener voicemails. One we can't play just because the connection was bad, but Eddie called in and he mentioned Taika Waititi's Hunt for the Wilder People, which I can't feel bad about because it's just opening
in
Chicago,
yet, yep.
I think, this weekend.
Possibly.
We'll get to
right.
those here in a moment. But other people called in. They've seen it. The film from New Zealand and that director who gave us What We Do in the Shadows and who stars in that movie. A lot of people are very enthused about that. So I can't wait to see it. A couple other titles. Obviously, I have to add The Invitation to that list. Michael, you're number 5. I really wanted to see a bigger splash. Haven't had time yet. The Shallows, I don't know if it would have made my list, but people say pretty good summer fare. The Chantel Ackerman movie, No Home Movie, Hong Sang-soo's Right Now, Wrong Then, Johnny Toes 3, and I feel bad that I have not yet caught up with Lemonade from one Beyoncé Knowles.
It's good.
I think it's about 25 times longer than Piper, so it really does count.
I am so
as
in
a potential
trouble.
Film of the year.
All right. Those are all of our picks and our honorable mentions and our regrets. We want to know what you think. Send us your number one film of the year or your top 5 or any other comments about the show. feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail at 312-264-0744 and you may hear it featured on an upcoming show. You can find Film Spotting on Facebook and we're also on Twitter. At Film Spotting, that's Adam. I'm at Larson on Film.
Over at filmspotting.net, you can find 11 years of reviews, marathons, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. While you're there, vote in the current Film Spotting poll. This has to be answered. It has to be reckoned with which director won the 2000s. And if you haven't already, we encourage you to check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. You heard from the bright people, despite our disagreement, Allison, over at Film Spotting SVU and The Next Picture Show. You can find both shows in iTunes. Out in limited release, opening this weekend here in Chicago, Captain Fantastic. Viggo Mortensen plays a father living off the grid with his 6 kids who try to assimilate back into society. I just learned that the writer, I think, and director of this film, Matt Ross, plays Gavin Belson on Silicon Valley on HBO, and he's hilarious. He's hilarious on that show, obviously multi-talented. Life Animated, the documentary about a family that used Disney films to connect with their autistic son, is out. And Nuts, Nuts with an exclamation point. I believe this played here at the Chicago Critics Film Festival. Josh, why don't you do the honors and read this out-of-context line from Noel Murray's review at the AV Club.
Ultimately, this isn't a film about goat balls at all, but the willingness of millions to believe that some slick-talking demagogue knows more about what's good for them and their families than someone with actual qualifications.
I smell a future top five list.
Kind of a spoiler there.
Actually, a Sundance award-winning documentary about a small-town Kansas doctor who in 1917 claimed that he had the cure for impotence. Our little sister also out. This from Japan's Hirokazu Koreeda, who gave us 2013's Like Father, Like Son. And because there hasn't been enough wiener talk, Wiener Dog, the latest from Todd Solondz. It's been described as Todd Solondz' Alhazar Balthazar, which means you can't wait to see this movie, Josh.
True.
It has a wiener dog in the role of the donkey and Greta Gerwig in the role of Don Wiener. Those are out now. Out wide, a little movie no one's talked about called Ghostbusters. And none of us have seen it as of right now, but we're planning to before next week's show, and we're going to review it and discuss Suzanne Beer's In a Better World. It's the fourth film in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon. You can rent it via iTunes and Amazon, or get it via Netflix DVD, or of course, just try your local library or your video store if it still exists. We love it when listeners play along.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week is by Michael Kiwanuka. Comes from his forthcoming album, Love and Hate. More information is at michaelkiwanuka.com. Michael, glad you were here to ease us back into our relationship.
And yet, yet undermine it a little.
A little bit.
Right? That really is what you're here for.
Thanks, guys. It was fun.
And chicagotribune.com/movies. That's where folks can find out what you're writing about. And on Twitter, you are...
Phillips Tribune. You know, that's really a fine way to get in there. And Facebook is a lovely entree point to the reviews as well.
Michael, it was fun, of course, and we look forward to having you back on the show soon. And, of course, at the end of the year when we unveil the surely set in stone, can't move any picks,
right,
top
right,
10
right.
Films
I'll deny I was ever here in July.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, thanks again. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Standing now. Calling all the people here to see the show. Calling for my demons now to let go.
So yeah, it's great following you on Facebook, and I go off with my family to Branson for a week, and meanwhile, you're in a Woody Allen movie.
Chris
watching
Rock,
fireworks
Chris
under
Rock
the bridge,
wasn't in Branson?
Going to the Comedy Cellar and staying at hoity-toity hotels. So, man, it must be rough being Josh Larson.
Well, you have it right. I wasn't at a hoity-toity hotel. It was at a friend's place, but they live on Manhattan, so it was pretty hoity-toity.
Hmm.
Comedy Cellar was my highlight,
I saw a picture posted from a hoity-toity hotel.
Well,
so.
We were probably just sneaking in
to
use the bathroom. We were... So the friends, they were both still working, and they have kids, Addie and B's age. So we're like, sure, we'll take your kids with us all day, you know, and that's fine, no problem. But then you've got the six of us walking around the city all day long. You know, bathroom needs aren't always timed perfectly for when you're eating lunch or whatever. So, yeah, let's check out the Waldorf Astoria.
I shouldn't give you any grief because I've actually stayed there before.
At the Waldorf?
Yeah, and it's incredible.
Lovely bathrooms.
Not on my
huh?
dime. It's incredible.
Our friend's
it's one
son,
of the best.
He was like, they've got carpeting in here. These paper towels are so soft. And he's whispering, right? Because we're not staying there. We're like, just be cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, they won't say anything if you look like you belong. Act like you belong, 10-year-old. He pulled it off.
Wow.
No trouble. Yeah, we had a great time. It was no movies. Went to New York City, did not see any movies.
Hmm.
Broadway, saw Wicked, tons of art.
How was it?
I liked it. I mean, the kids loved it. Adeline, who's the musical theater
Josh,
obsessive.
Ripping on something insanely
well,
popular.
It's sort of, it's one of those prequely or sequely things that doesn't really line up too well, I feel like, to the movie. in terms of character motivation and that sort of stuff. There's probably three great songs in it. I'll give it that. The performances were fantastic. I mean, just really funny. Brought out the humor in it, especially Glinda, who I can't recall who is off the top of my head right now. So yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. It's not one of my favorite musicals, that's all. So that was good, but Comedy Cellar, man, that was the one place I wanted to go, right, when I knew we were going to do this trip. And I didn't care who was there, and you can't really tell often, right?
I saw the people who were in line, but you saw them perform?
What do you mean?
Who performed?
Well, who performed was like a group of four people. The only one I recognized was Todd Barry. We went to a 7:30 Wednesday night show. Todd Barry was on the lineup, so I thought, that's cool. I know him from Louie. Let's see what his act is like, his stand-up act. And he was really good. He was like, you know, the pro on the list. The others were fine. One guy was pretty bad. But I like bad stand-up, too, because, as I think I've said before, these are just the bravest souls on the planet to me. And it's just fascinating to see somebody up there, even struggling, and I'm still just in awe that they're up there.
Valid.
So we get out of our show and enjoyed it, and we're about to leave. We're talking about where we're going to, you know, get a drink or something to eat. And this Lamborghini pulls up, and our friend, she starts screaming, Tracy Morgan, Tracy Morgan, like repeat, like she loses her mind.
No kidding.
And I'm kind
no
of like,
chill at
and
all.
She's not normally like this. So I was like, I didn't know you were a celebrity hound. And she was right. And he just gets out of the car and he hangs out on the sidewalk there. There's a little cafe, part of it, I think, upstairs. And he hangs out at the table and he's scribbling stuff down on a note and talking about, we were there, it was like 90 degrees all week, like about everybody outside isn't wearing any drawers and just kind of just talking to the air. And he was doing warming up for going on stage. So we're like, we got to get back in there. And of course, there's already, I'll spare you the story, but we got back in.
You did.
We did get back in. Tracy Morgan is great. The MC comes up and he's like, and you guys had no idea you were going to see that tonight. How about, what a crazy night. He goes, what? The only thing that would make this night crazier if I said, next up is Chris Rock.
No.
And he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Chris Rock.
Come on.
Adam, our table is like 12 feet from the stage. And have you been to Comedy Cellar?
No.
Tiny place, right? Tiny underground place. He waltzes up there, says, I think this is the second time I've been on stage since the Oscars, launches into 25 minutes, and it was some raw stuff about, I don't know if it's like about to be finalized or what, but basically his divorce, which I know from looking it up afterwards has been going on, I think, for like 2 years now. So I don't know what prompted it, but it was just blistering, raw, angry, a lot of great stuff about lawyers and some pretty insane stuff about his soon-to-be ex-wife and the kid situation. I mean, it was like really, you just felt really bad for the guy. And,
okay.
And of course, who knows the story, right? Who knows what's going on? But it's still a guy who is in clear pain, working it out through his comedy, some funny stuff too, obviously. And it was like my dream. Like I said to Debbie, if the one person I would have wanted to see at Comedy Cellar with Louis,
yeah,
CK, after that probably would have been Chris Rock. Like if I could have picked anyone. So that just made my week. I was like, we can do whatever else everybody wants.
Right.
I'm set. I'm golden.
Yeah.
So it was good.
It makes me think I've got the exact opposite version of that in terms of being the whitest story ever. Oh my God, this is going to make me sound so white, but it's true. When I went to London in 1995, I told people that I'm going there for 4 months, and I would make a joke about who I was going to meet,
mm-hmm,
what famous Brits I was going to meet and hang out with. And I said, yeah, you know, I'm going to hang out with Sting, right? And I do like Sting. I mean,
okay.
I love The Police, and I was a bigger fan of Sting at the time, but still a great musician. And Kenneth Branagh, right? Because of my love for Henry V and some other things he's done, but especially Henry V, Branagh is my guy. So I'd make jokes about that. And then I go over there, and the London Film Festival is going on, and Sting is in a movie that like his wife's in it and she produced it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so me and my buddy Eric get tickets and then we just go in and sit down before the movie and Sting comes and sits in the row in front of us.
Oh my gosh.
So I met Sting. And then Kenneth Branagh.
Did you get to talk to him and stuff?
This is my great celebrity
encounter. What awkward thing did you say to Sting?
It's great. This is the great line ever that he gave back to me that shows that he just wanted nothing to do with talking to any of his fans. I said something like, you know what? I don't remember now what I said. It might have just been a generic, really big fan.
I appreciate your work.
Pleasure to meet you or something like that. And he said, I have a cold and now you have my cold.
No way. That is crazy.
That's what he said to me.
That
now
is
you
brilliant.
Have my cold.
That is so...
Because he shook my hand.
I was going to say, this sounds like you were doing more than just talking to him.
No,
this,
it really
was. This sounds
wasn't.
Like a hug.
It really was not.
Did you force a hug on Sting?
Now, I almost forced a hug, or should have forced a hug, with Kenneth Branagh. He had a premiere of his movie that nobody saw called The Midwinter's Tale.
Yeah.
He premiered it in Belfast, which is his hometown, I believe.
Okay.
And I'm like, this is my chance. Like, there was like a private reception afterwards. If you bought a ticket to the movie, you got into the private reception. You got to have drinks. You got to meet Kenneth Branagh. And I flew from London to Belfast because everything was so cheap at the time in London. If you were a student,
is reaching stalker level.
If you were a student, you could get around anywhere at the time. And I flew there. I'm going to see this movie. I didn't actually really think I was going to meet him, but I was just going to be there, and that was going to be enough. And then I did get a chance to actually talk to him. Can't remember again what I said. He signed the back of my ticket, all the best, Kenneth Branagh or whatever. But I didn't get a picture. I had some random person like get a picture of me. But then before I could pose with him, he started signing someone else's autograph. So it looks totally like one of those like flyby pictures
where
you're
leaning in.
Yeah, you're leaning in and putting your face next to Kenneth Branagh. It's the best.
You know, you should have gone up to him and just said, "You have my cold now."
I should have.
See how he responded. Well, that was probably before mobile phones too, right?
Yeah.
So this was like...
Oh, way before.
Yeah. So you had to hand someone your real camera.
Yeah, a camera. An actual camera. Totally.